Tactics with Caleb Colquitt. Every weekday from 9 to 11. Only on News Radio 1440 and NewsRadio1440.com.
We're all over the place there for a second. All right, well, it is good to be back with you, and I do apologize for not being with you on Friday, and then, of course, we had the big holiday on Monday and Tuesday. So I've been out quite a bit recently. It's weird. I know that you guys are probably feeling the same grind as I am, probably haven't been to work either Monday or Tuesday because that's just the way the holidays happen to fall this year. But if you are there, thank you so much for being with us. We appreciate you coming on and making us a part of your day, and we are going to be getting back on a regular schedule now that we are back in the work week, and this is going to happen for everybody. One thing that you've probably noticed is that everybody's kind of walking around in a stupor in the holidays. They're so busy with their family, they're so busy with everything else. They don't really pay a ton of attention to the news or to politics in general. But it's going to start picking up here in a little bit, and because of that, there is a lot to cover. There's a lot to cover on the national stage, but first, we're going to stay right here in the state of Alabama, because even though this happened on the national stage, this involves representatives that we elected and that we sent to Washington. The Alabama delegation has spoken out about the situation with the continuing government shutdown and with everything that's going on in the border. Senator Richard Shelby, who's been the senator longer than I've been alive. And no, that's not an exaggeration. He actually has been the senator in the state of Alabama for longer than I have been alive, because he got elected before the year I was born in 1989. So Senator Shelby been there for, well, pretty much forever, at least from my perspective. He was on CBS's Face the Nation the other day. And what they asked him about was, of course, the government shutdown. That's what they asked pretty much everybody about right now, because it is a pressing, looming issue in Washington. And he said that he believes that the shutdown makes lawmakers look, quote, silly, and that they should move away from the blame game. Now, I wanted to go ahead and say that I think that Senator Shelby is a decent senator. I don't think that he's necessarily a great one. In fact, I opposed him with his primary candidate Jonathan McConnell. I actually was pulling for McConnell at the time. And so I don't think that Shelby is by any means a great senator. I don't think he's Jeff Sessions. I don't think that he's somebody that is going to go to the mat for conservative issues. I mean, we're talking about a guy who used to be a Democrat. Make no mistake about that. This is a guy who used to be a Democrat, and that's how he got elected originally. So I don't think that Senator Richard Shelby is some kind of great conservative. I've met the man. He seems like a nice guy personally, but I don't know that he's this conservative warrior. In fact, I'm fairly certain that he isn't. I think he learned a long time ago that if he votes at least a little conservative sometimes, then because he's got all the name recognition, because he has all the money, then he can stay in office pretty much as long as he wants to. And he's voted just conservative enough to keep him from losing a primary. And the strategy has worked well for him. So the other day he says that the shutdown does make lawmakers look silly and they should move away from the blame game. I think that's largely true. I think that the shutdown does make lawmakers look incompetent. Even if you happen to, like I do, agree with the shutdown, if you're looking at it at its basis form, it is a failure of government to function. And part of the reason it doesn't function is because our Congress has not passed a budget in a decade. Now, granted, there are some things that I think you should go to the mat for, and I think that are worth a government shutdown. I think this issue happens to be one of them. I agree with the shutdown. I agree with Donald Trump taking a stand and saying, nope, not going to sign it unless it has funding for the border wall. I thought that was a good call. However, even though that is the case, it does still make the government look silly. Because on Trump's case, like I said before, he really should have fought this issue 2 years ago. This shouldn't be something that he kicked the can down the road and waited until he is weeks away from Nancy Pelosi being Speaker of the House to have to fight this issue on. That's a really dumb move, because then you're playing against the Democrats and playing against the clock. And so what really should have happened is this is a fight we should have been having 2 years ago. And when it comes to the budget, Congress has not passed a budget in a decade. If they had done their constitutionally mandated job, then we wouldn't be having this fight in the first place, whether you agree with the shutdown or not. And so, on a fundamental level, I think that what Richard Shelby is saying here is actually correct. So let's read a little bit from this interview. We've got to move away from the blame game of blaming the president, blaming Democrats, Pelosi, Schumer, and others, and get back to doing what we were sent there to do, fund the government. Okay, on that I actually agree with him. Like I've said, it takes two sides to shut down the government every single time. It happens whether it was instigated by one side or the other, no matter what the circumstances surrounding it are. It takes both the Democrats and the Republicans to shut down the government unless one side has all the branches of government, you know, minus the judiciary, because they're not really involved in the shutdown process, and a veto-proof, majority-proof in Congress. If you have a supermajority of 60 or more and can pass whatever you want, then you could kind of blame it on one party, but that has not happened in a long time. And so understanding that means that both sides are definitely to blame here. Richard Shelby, 100% correct on that. He says, that's been my mandate. That's what we've been working on hard this year in a bipartisan way on the Appropriations Committee. Senator Leahy, a senator from Vermont, he is the ranking Democrat on the committee. I believe if people would help us along, we would do what we need to do with the 75% we funded the government. Fund it all, the sooner the better. All right, so first of all, let's look at Senator Shelby's statement in a vacuum. I agree with everything that he said. I can't find one syllable of one word in that entire statement that I disagree with. Here's the problem, though. The context, the connotation of what Senator Shelby said, I think is problematic. And the reason that I say that is he seems to be giving off this vibe, and maybe I'm reading too much into it, but I really don't think I am, considering Shelby's career. He seems to be giving off this vibe of, let's just do whatever it takes to keep the government open. And Senator Shelby certainly kind of, at least by nothing else, his silence, kind of insinuated that he's okay with that. Because remember that when the budget that had no funding for the wall in it at all was put forward to the Senate, it was Senator Richard Shelby that voted in favor of it. And so basically, the connotation of what he's saying sounds like he's taking the position of the Democrats, which is, well, let's just kick the can down the road and not worry about the border wall, and let's just do what we did last time. Which, again, is nothing, there's nothing conservative about that. If nothing else, even if you take the border security and the border wall issue out of it entirely, there's nothing conservative about passing a budget that puts Donald Trump on pace to double what Barack Obama spent. And that is the responsibility of Barack Obama, but it's also the responsibility of the Congress, the House and the Senate, that gave him those budgets and those continuing resolutions to sign. And so what we're doing is more of the same. I mean, Shelby is the definition of a swamp person. And he's showing that in this statement as well. He's basically suggesting, again, I don't think that you could take the raw statement and say that this is what he's saying, but it seems to me that he's very much suggesting, let's just not worry about the border wall, let's just go ahead and pass it. We need to pass it, we need to go ahead, and we need to fund the government fully, and the sooner the better. Well, there are certain things that are worth shutting the government down for. And frankly, my threshold on that is probably a lot lower than most people's, because I don't really see that shutting down the government has all these detrimental effects that we seem to keep hearing about, which, if anything, this latest shutdown should be a sterling example of that, because have you heard about any kind of big problems really ensuing from this? Because I haven't. I mean, I've been watching people not really paying attention to the news, spending the holiday with their family. Most people don't even know the government is shut down. That's how minuscule this shutdown actually is, and how little effect it has on our personal lives. Now, there are some people that are federal employees that this is affecting. And I'm not saying that that doesn't matter, but I'm saying on the larger scale, unless you are somehow directly involved in the federal government, you probably just didn't notice. And so I think Shelby's, what's the word I'm looking for? His vigor in reopening the government is somewhat misplaced. And it is not necessarily shared by the vast majority of Americans, specifically Alabamians. I don't think that most of us have this itch for government to be open, that have this strong, abiding desire to make sure that the government is always open and always funded 100% of the time. There are certain parts of the government that need to be defunded. And frankly, I am terribly upset at both sides of Congress, the House and the Senate, for not using what was referred to as the power of the purse by James Madison in the Federalist Papers. I don't understand why they haven't opted to pass budgets that don't fund a lot of big, progressive, big government things. I say I don't understand it, actually I do. The truth is they're progressives too, and they want a big, robust federal government too because it means that they have more power. They just want to be the ones in charge of it. Because at one point in this country, the argument was, should we have a bigger government or a smaller government? Now the question is, let's all agree that we all want big government. It's just the Republicans want to drive the big government. No, the Democrats want to drive the big government. That's really the only debate that we have right now, and it's a shame that it has come to that. So that's really the issue that I have with Shelby's statement, is it almost is palpable that he really wants the government to be opened up again. And I think part of the reason is because Shelby, being a government person, someone that's been in government and entrenched in government long as he has, he realizes that, man, if the federal government stays shut down for too long and people start realizing it's really not that big a deal, maybe they'll start getting the idea that they don't really need me as much as I've tried to persuade them that they do. And considering that Senator Shelby is the king of kickbacks and pork barrel spending, I can see why he would feel as though that might be a danger to him. And granted, I do want to give Senator Shelby credit, because he's actually been pretty decent on this issue. And he did say in this very interview that his goal was to secure the border, but he was very careful about saying, it seemed to me that he was trying to avoid saying that he actually wanted to govern a actual wall. He did say that he doesn't think Trump actually wants a government shutdown, so he didn't try to, you know, he didn't play the Democrat game where he's like, well, you know, I think that Trump really wants a government shutdown, and that's really what he's bucking for. Trump doesn't want a government shutdown, but he's willing to have one if it means that he gets a border wall. And I think that is a sentiment that is shared by me and a lot of Americans, especially the ones that happen to, unlike me, vote for him. And so when it comes to this, I understand the sentiment behind this, and I think that Shelby is, at the very least, hedging his bets and not trying to openly oppose the president out there in the open. But it still has at least a twinge of Senator Shelby's signature, well, I really like the government, I want the government to stay open, and we need to go ahead and do it even if it means compromising our principles. Unfortunately, that seems to be Shelby's stock and trade, and I see him as kind of being someone that would be perfectly okay with opening the government, whether or not we actually got a border wall out of it. Now, sort of on the opposite side of that, we have Mo Brooks, of course, in the House of Representatives, and one of, in my opinion, the best members of Alabama's delegation. He's a part of the Freedom Caucus, one of the ones that helped put together that budget that did include the $5 billion for the border wall, so he was a instrumental part of that. He was part of the group that helped put that together. Mo Brooks kind of taking the opposite approach on it. He went on Del Jackson's Guerrilla Politics the other day, and he talked about the thousands of American deaths due to illegal immigration. And he's talking about everything from accidental homicides to full-on murder, drug use that is coming across the border in droves. And that's not to mention organized crime that does go out and kill people, like the MS-13. You know, we have potential terrorists that have come across the border, and we found out that there have been a few jihadists and other terrorists that have come across that way. And so there's a lot of reasons to be leery of this. And Mo Brooks sort of points that out. And then he goes on to say this. So the question is going to be, how much blood, American blood, do you have to have on the hands of Democrat leaders like Nancy Pelosi and Chuck Schumer before they will help us on border security? Or is their craving for power such that they are willing to accept the loss of American lives? So here's my question on this. Is this a fair point? Because typically speaking, I'm always very leery of using really violent language when describing that or attributing motive. Because I don't think that the Democrat leadership in Nancy Pelosi, Chuck Schumer, I do not think they are intentionally trying to kill Americans by keeping our borders open. However, they do know about this. They are aware of the situation. I mean, they'd be completely sealed off in a bubble if they didn't. And I do think to a certain degree they're insulated in Washington and sealed off into a bubble. But I mean, they're at least hearing the stories, if nothing else, I would have to imagine, or else they're completely ignorant of everything, and I don't believe that for a second. So, if we're looking at Nancy Pelosi and Chuck Schumer and the other Democrats that are opposing the border security, opposing the border wall, then you have to ask the question, are they at the very least complacent? Because I think that's what the point that Mo Brooks is actually trying to make here. He makes it very graphically, but the overall point that he's trying to make is that the Democrats are at the very least complacent in saying, you know what, if we lose some American lives to drugs, if some people get raped and murdered by some of these illegal immigrants, that's a small price to pay for flipping Texas blue. That's a small price to pay for breeding a new generation of Democrat voters. Now, they would never articulate it that way, and I don't even know that they would necessarily think that way in their heads, but you can tell by their actions, that seems to be the logical conclusion that they have reached, even if they wouldn't necessarily spell it out that way. And that's the point that Mo Brooks is saying. And so while I don't necessarily like using this particular kind of language, and I think that it attributes intent a little too much, you know, you kind of have to say that at a certain point, Mo Brooks is making a lot of sense on that. And you do have to take a step back and say, at the very least, they're complacent in it. At the very least, they're apathetic towards it as long as it continues to give them more power and more influence and ensure the Democrats win more elections, and that is a problem. So, speaking of some local news, and we are going to have, I'll tell you what, we'll go ahead and just jump straight into this. So, there were prosecutors that came to Montgomery on Monday. So, that night, protesters arrived at the home of Attorney General Steve Marshall. Now, this was not New Year's Eve night. When I say it was Monday, it would have been the night before. So, you know, what you're dealing with there, that I guess it would have been Sunday night, Monday morning. I'm not sure exactly on the timeline. I didn't see the story. The story was posted at 7 a.m. the next day. So, it would have been New Year's Eve day that I saw the story. But anyway, the night before, regardless of how you're defining that, the night before, protesters showed up at the house of Steve Marshall to protest what was going on in Hoover with the shooting of, E.J. Bradford Jr. and the whole saga that's been going on with that, which, by the way, I really am just kind of fatigued at this story, and we'll get into that in just a second. But protesters arrived at Attorney General Marshall's home to protest something. I mean, I know it was in connection with that, but what I can't figure out is what they're protesting. That's the thing that kind of strikes me as odd. Because are you protesting Steve Marshall doing an investigation? Because if you are, then it's going to be real hard to find answers. Are you protesting that the investigation hasn't provided certain information? Because they really haven't had time to do it yet. Steve Marshall's office has only been in charge of that, what, a week now? And if you're protesting Steve Marshall, I don't know, taking over the investigation, that to me also seems pretty strange because there were a lot of concerns from both sides about the objectivity of the district attorney there in Jefferson County, which I'm not knocking him or anything. And Steve Marshall even said in his statement that he's not saying that he was biased, but there's at least the appearance of bias, which qualifies as a reason for him in his department to take it over. And so I'm just really confused about what they're protesting here. And especially when you consider that his investigation has not actually produced anything, I don't understand exactly what you're protesting or upset about. for example, if we're going to look into investigations, I totally understand people being upset, including myself, because I've talked about this quite a bit, at James Comey saying that there was no, basically based on their findings, that they were not going to prosecute Hillary Clinton, even though they laid out a criminal case, specifically telling you why that would basically be a very viable case to press charges on. But see, the odd part about all this is that in Attorney General Marshall's case, he hasn't actually produced any findings. And so the odd thing about this is they're protesting a verdict that has yet to come out. They don't know what Attorney General Marshall is going to find. It would be one thing if Attorney General Marshall, even if it happened to be incorrect, like let's just say that everything that the protesters believe happened to be true. Let's say that the police officer was in the wrong, that he fired on the guy even though it was not justified, and killed an innocent person, which is still a possibility. Let's just say that took place. Well, Attorney General Marshall might find that. Protesting him now doesn't make any sense. Now, if you believe that and you hold on to that narrative and evidence comes out even to the contrary and it turns out that that was what happened, then, again, wouldn't you wait until Attorney General Marshall came out and said, nope, that's not what happened? Wouldn't you wait until then to protest? Because as of yet, you're protesting something that you don't even know whether it's happened yet or not. And so them showing up at Attorney General Steve Marshall's house just doesn't make any sense. And another thing that I would also point out is that they showed up at his home. It's one thing to show up at the man's office. Look, he's a government official. He is in the public eye. And you, as citizens of the state of Alabama and the United States, have every right to show up and protest, and you have freedom of assembly. Even if I disagree with the protest, even if I think it doesn't make sense that you're protesting, you have a right to do that at the man's office or in a public space. You do not have the right to do that at his residence. That is private property, and if you step onto it uninvited, you are trespassing. You are breaking the law by doing that. So if you want to protest, whether I agree with your protest or not, whether it makes sense to me or not, you have the right to do it. Do it at the man's office. Do it when he's there, where it actually makes sense and he can actually see you out there. Don't just go protesting at the man's private residence. That doesn't make any sense. You do not have the right to be there. You have the right to assembly, you have the right to protest, but not on a person's private property. That's no more or less legal than if someone just randomly busted into your home for no reason and said, no, I have a right to be here. Or if you're going to cite the right to assembly, that would be like saying that because you have the right to be at his house, that would be like saying I have a right to throw a party at some random person's house without telling them first. Well, I am assembling, but there's a difference in that and actually being able to be allowed on that property. So if you're going to protest, just do it at the guy's office. And along the same lines, on this same story, Carlos Chavez Jr., well, I'm not sure what happened there. According to my software, it says that the Facebook limit of 240 minutes was reached, but we were nowhere near that, so I'm not sure exactly what's going on. Facebook is probably just censoring me. I'm sure it was just some kind of technical error, but it wouldn't surprise me, although you did hear that there was, probably over the weekend, I don't know if you heard this or not, but there was actually a kerfuffle about Facebook censorship yet again. They were actually banning people and getting rid of posts that referred to the police officer that was killed by an illegal immigrant for referring to the cop killer as an illegal immigrant, which he was. They referred to him either as an illegal immigrant or an illegal alien, they were banning the post. So Facebook, unfortunately, engaging in censorship yet again, something that we have been all aware of. So I don't think that Facebook was actually censoring me on that one. I don't know, maybe. But probably not. I'm sure that they weren't monitoring it that close. But I don't know. It's just funny that Facebook, this is the thing that really does get under the skin of conservatives, is that constantly we're told, oh, it's just the algorithms. Facebook is just it's a completely neutral, completely open source, and you're not being censored. We're only stopping things that go against our community standards. Well, if referring to someone who is an illegal immigrant as an illegal immigrant violates the community standards, then you are absolutely taking a political stance. I mean, that's not an opinion. That's just the truth. And you cannot refer to that as hate speech when it's the person's actual immigration status. So, again, Facebook has a problem with the truth there. But back to the story before we were so rudely cut off. So, Carlos Chavez Jr., who's sort of the ringleader for all of the protest in the Hoover area, has actually been banned from the Galleria for a full year. So, according to this, should he set foot on the Galleria property before December 15th, 2019, he will be subject to arrest. And here's the thing about this. This is a perfectly reasonable stance to take as a private business. The Galleria is a private entity. They own private property, which means that if they want to, it is within their purview, it is their prerogative 100%, that if they want to ban somebody that is actively trying to disrupt business, then they can do so. And frankly, they don't even have to ban him just because he's trying to disrupt business. I mean, they could ban him just because they don't like the color of his shirt or something. They could do that if they wanted to. They would be within their legal right to do so. But this guy has actively said he wants to shut down the Galleria. He's encouraging people not to go there, not to shop there. And he's been showing up with his protesters and mobs and everything, trying to disrupt business inside the mall. Which, it's perfectly reasonable for the Galleria to say, this person is actively trying to hurt our business, ergo, he needs to go. That is a reasonable stance to take from them. No different than if you had somebody in a restaurant that was shouting and yelling at the top of their lungs, then you would be allowed to tell them to go. And that would be a reasonable thing for you to do as well. I'm somebody that has worked in those positions. I have been security before. There were times where I had to throw people out. It wasn't pleasant. I didn't like doing it. But that's what the job entails. And as a private business, if you have anybody that is impeding your ability to make money, that's what you got to do, because that's what you are there for. You are a business that is there to turn a profit. And if somebody is endangering that profit, that is endangering your business as a whole. I've worked at hotels where I had to throw people out because we were getting noise complaints or they were being disorderly. There were different restaurants that I was in. I used to work at the Moe's at Auburn. And the Moe's at Auburn, for those of you who know downtown Auburn, is right next to Skybar. Normally, that's fine. We get a lot of traffic from Skybar, people that have been drinking a little bit. They want to go to Moe's, get some quick dinner, and then head home. That's fine. We welcome that. But if they start being a belligerent drunk, then I've got to throw them out. And I had to do that quite a few times. Why? Because it disturbs your other customers and impedes your ability to make money. If you become known as a hangout for drunks, where you're not going to be able to sit down and have a quiet meal with your buddies, then that is going to be a problem for your business in the future. And so you've got to be able to do that. And this thing with what they're doing with the Galleria, perfectly within their purview to do so. And what's hilarious about this is he said that this is unconstitutional. The Galleria is a private business. They're not subject to the Constitution. Only the federal government can break that. So this idea that a private business can somehow violate your constitutional rights is just stupid. Look, you have a right to freedom of speech, but if you're in my house and you start swearing in front of kids, I have a right to kick you out because I view that as an immoral behavior. The government can't do that, but I can do that. It's the same thing with anything else. You cannot violate someone's constitutional rights as a private business. This guy, Carlos Chavez Jr., look, he has every right to say whatever he wants about the Galleria, as stupid or misguided as it may be. But he doesn't have a right to do it on their property. He can say whatever he wants to, organize boycotts, organize protests, whatever he wants to do. But he does not have a right to be at the Galleria while he does it. So I'm all for freedom of speech, even when I think the speech is stupid, like in this particular case. You have a freedom of assembly. You can assemble for whatever reason you want to. But you don't have a right to do it on private property. And so these protesters seemingly have a real problem with understanding that notion. Well, unfortunately, I've run out of time. They're giving me the signal from outside, and so it looks like we've got a client here at Cumulus. And speaking of impeding business, if I stay on the air and keep a client out of the studio, I would be the one impeding business, and Cumulus would want to kick me out. So because of that, we're going to go ahead and end the show. But before we do, I real quickly wanted to go ahead and do a quick chaplain's report. If I can go ahead and get the graphic pulled up. Chaplain's report this morning comes from the Book of Daniel. We've been continuing our little series on the Book of Daniel, which I think has been very enlightening and something that I have thoroughly enjoyed. I love Daniel as a character. And you may remember that the last time we talked about Daniel and his three friends are caught in this situation where they are expected, as people that have been captured and taken to Babylon, to partake of the king's food, indulge in his culture. And because they have dietary laws that they're supposed to adhere to in the law of Moses, they have a problem with eating the king's meat because it's not been killed properly. It's not been killed by a rabbi. There's probably a lot of meats in there that they are not actually allowed to partake in, like pork. And so because of this, they've said that they will not defile themselves with the king's meat and the king's wine. And so they're trying to find a way around this. So I want us to go now to Daniel 1, 9 through 10. Now, God granted Daniel favor and compassion in the sight of the commander of the officials. And the commander of the officials said to Daniel, I am afraid of my lord the king, who has appointed your food and your drink. For why should he see your faces looking more haggard than the youths, who are your own age? Then you would make me forfeit my own head to the king. Now, a couple things I wanted to point out here. First of all, remember that the overseer is not a Jew. And from his perspective, what he's saying here is perfectly reasonable. It's not because he hates Daniel and hates his three friends, or he thinks that what they're saying is somehow wrong. He's just saying, look, if I present you to the king, and you look more haggard and you look less well-fed than all these other guys, then I'm in trouble. And then I may be killed, because I didn't make you partake of these things. Now, God did grant Daniel and his friends favor and compassion, the scripture says. So God was still with Daniel and still thinking about this and still had him in mind. But I want you to think about this for a second. This overseer who does not know the law of Moses and doesn't know about God, he has to have an awful lot of trust in God for this to take place. Because he had every motivation for defying God and saying, nope, you guys, I'm going to make you partake of the king's food, and that's just tough, because I am not risking my life for your beliefs. And honestly, from his perspective, that probably seemed pretty reasonable. But yet, God has compassion on Daniel, and because Daniel and his friends really want to follow God's word, God provides a way for them to do so. He works in the heart of the overseer and grants them favor in his sight so that he'll at least hear them out and consider this. And because God granted Daniel favor in his sight, the Lord basically is saying to us, I think this is the lesson and the takeaway from this, that God is always going to make a way. If we have a desire to follow God's word, if we have a desire to follow what he does for us, God is always going to make a way. Now, that way may not always be as convenient as it was here for Daniel. And in fact, Daniel himself will learn that even though God always makes a way for you to follow his will, he doesn't always necessarily make it easy for you. He may in this particular instance, but there are later times, for example, in the lion's den that we'll look at in a little bit, that following God's will is not easy, and it's not something that is done without a lot of courage. But this is a recurring theme in the scriptures, that even when horrible things happen to good people, God always makes a way for them to follow his will. We see it with Daniel. We see it with, for example, Joseph, who did the right thing and got punished for it. He did the right thing by denying Potiphar's wife having an affair with him and wound up getting punished for it, even though he did the right thing and did what he was supposed to do. And yet, God always makes a way of escape. He always makes a way for us to be able to follow him and be in accordance with his will if we have a willingness to do so. And here's one of the big points of this whole scripture. being God's people means we have to stick out some. Being God's people means that we are going to be different from the rest of the world, that people are going to be able to observe something in us that they do not see in others. And that means that sometimes we are going to be the subject of ridicule. Sometimes we are going to be the odd man out. But that's the kind of obedience that God calls us to. But here's another thing, too. You'll notice that God granted Daniel favor in his sight. But Daniel and Joseph both got the favor of those around them by being good people, by being exceptional, by being people that had a good moral compass and actually stuck to it and followed it. And because of that, Daniel and his friends gained favor in the sight of the overseer. And as Christians, this is something that should happen to us as well. There are going to be people that ridicule us, sure, but it should also mean that from some people's perspectives, Christians ought to be the people that make the best employees, the best friends, the best neighbors, the best spouses, or the best family member, whether it's an aunt, uncle, cousin, whatever. There should be something about us that is different from the rest of the world, and there will be good people that appreciate that in us, even if they don't share our beliefs. Sometimes we're going to face persecution anyway, but it also means that we're going to gain favor with some people. There were some situations that when I was working with people that were non-believers, that I got put in rough situations. But I was given a lot of benefit of the doubt because they knew that I was a Christian and that I meant what I said, that I was honest, that I tried really hard. And so sometimes, even when I messed up, I was given the benefit of the doubt. I gained favor in people's sight, just like Daniel and Joseph and other Bible characters. Because when you're really breaking it all down, everything in our life should be to serve the kingdom of God and to serve our fellow man. And our life should be the biggest testament to that. We should live the kind of life that other people look at us and say, you know what, I want to be a Christian too. I want what he has. We should be the biggest walking advertisements for people that follow the teachings of Jesus. And if we do that, we have done our jobs as Christians. Stay the course, friends.
Tactics with Caleb Colquitt. Every weekday from 9 to 11. Only on News Radio 1440 and NewsRadio1440.com.